The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. And today I'd like to talk about what is called the bright guardians of the world. And I like to think of them as the guardians of the world and the guardians of the heart. And these are two mental qualities, mental states, that are also considered to be beautiful states of mind, beautiful factors of mind. So it's supposed to be a happy thing. And it relates to the English word conscience. Conscience meaning the self-reflective ability to be sensitive to one's moral orientation towards the world, moral sensitivity, ethical sensitivity. And it's fascinating, this word conscience, moral conscience, that it's related to the word consciousness. And until the 1700s, 17th century in Europe, the word conscience, used to mean conscience, like moral conscience. It was only in the 17th century that the meaning of that word started to change to become what we call now consciousness, which is more of a, maybe a, you know, ethically or morally neutral field of perception or awareness that goes on. And many of us take this word consciousness so much for granted that we think it's a thing. And it seems that at least in Western Europe, it's only been a thing for the last 300-400 years. I don't know what they did. How they managed before that. But apparently, they were fine without selecting out or defining this particular thing. But whatever consciousness. So in the past, consciousness was associated with this moral sensitivity, this moral sensibility, that now we associate to the word conscience. When you look at the word mindfulness. And how mindfulness is taught in the West, there's a strong tendency, I believe, to teach mindfulness as in the way it's taught or defined, as an ethically neutral phenomena, where we're taught mindfulness, you're supposed to have non-judgmental and non-evaluative awareness of what's happening in the present moment. And that non-judgmental and non-evaluative suggests that it's not there to make any moral judgments or moral evaluations whatsoever. But you find that in the teachings of the Buddha, there is an intimate connection between mindfulness and the ethical life. That mindfulness, the Buddha gave instructions that one of the functions of mindfulness is to abandon the unskillful or unwholesome states of mind. The favorite way of talking about ethics in the ancient language was not with our word ethics, but rather was this word that means either unskillful or unwholesome. Different people prefer different ones of those choices. And that the function of mindfulness was to abandon the unskillful, the unwholesome, the unethical, and help us to enter into the skillful, the wholesome. That mindfulness is a way of abandoning the unethical behaviors of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and intoxication. So mindfulness is not just something, just simply be aware of it all. It has an impact. To observe our experience in a deep way changes our relationship to the experience, changes us in some way. The Buddha also talked about how mindfulness, the function of mindfulness, is to abandon wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. The first five of the Eightfold Path. And it's on the other side, the function of mindfulness is to support the growth of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And a wonderful kind of analogy the Buddha uses for all this is that of a gatekeeper. Of in the old world, they had these fortified cities. There was a wall around the city. And everything that came in and out of the gate was known by the gatekeeper. And the Buddha said that mindfulness is the gatekeeper that helps us to abandon what's unskillful. And I think he made it a little more dramatic than that. Abandon what is wicked and unskillful and support that which is beautiful and skillful. So we see that in mindfulness, there's a kind of intimate connection with ethical sensibility. And I'd like to believe that that's because ethical sensibility is a deeply ingrained or deeply almost biological instinct that we have. And that the particular ethical kind of guardians or guides that we have in our psyche are something in Pali is called hiri and otapa. Hiri and otapa are those what's called the guardians of the world. And the question is, how do we translate these words? And because many of the English choices don't evoke the idea of beauty for me. Remember I said in the beginning that these words are part of the beautiful factors of the mind. And so they kind of quite don't do it for me, but maybe they do it for you. So things like moral shame and moral dread. That's a common translation. Is that beautiful? Yeah? Good. And then what are some of the others that I've heard or read about? There is I've seen shame and compunction. I'm not quite sure what compunction means, but I have looked up in the dictionary, and it seems like what you the guilt you feel after you've done something. So this hiri and otapa. So what is it? Part of the teachings of these two words, these ideas, is they come from respect. They come from self-respect and respect of others. And so how does one acquire self-respect? How does one relate to oneself with self-respect? And I think this practice that we do, the practice of Buddhism, is in fact a practice to develop self-respect, a sense of self-worth, self-valuing of oneself, even to the degree to which Buddhism emphasizes the idea of not-self. To that degree, it also emphasized the tremendous respecting of oneself as well. And so if you really respect yourself, you wouldn't harm yourself in any way. So my discovery of these qualities was on sitting long retreats. And sitting long meditation retreats was a way where I settled the mind, quieted the mind, calmed it down, so that the normal agitations of my mind were no longer present. And some of those, or maybe many of those agitations, had their genesis in unhealthy or unskillful states of mind. There was lust, there was aversion, there was greed, there was fear, there was all kinds of things kind of circling and operating, kept my mind busy and engaged. That actually made it hard to settle and to see what was going on. But on a long retreat, my mind settled and quieted. And what I experienced, which was surprised me, the language I used for it, because I wasn't into this language, but the best language I could use to describe what I was feeling inside was purity. And then if I tried to kind of avoid it, because I was uncomfortable with that word, coming out of the 60s or something. And so in trying to avoid it, I've tried to use the word clean, like a cleanliness inside, inner sense of cleanliness. And that works a little better for an ex-hippie, like I was. So, but the sense of inner purity, a kind of clarity and openness, unfragmented, nothing is torn, everything is whole kind of feeling. And that, and then I was surprised that as I had certain thoughts, which I won't share with you, I could feel that wholeness would start to get torn, or I could feel like there was a kind of like I was harming myself, this place of purity inside, and it felt ouch. You know, why would I do that? And so that gave me a strong sense that there was some kind of guide inside of me, a kind of an ethical guide, or a guide to avoid certain kinds of behavior, certain kind of thoughts even, certain kinds of speech acts, that somehow didn't align or was not in harmony with this inner sense of goodness that was there. And then that inner sense of goodness also taught me the value of doing the opposite. The value of not closing down, not tearing the fabric of the heart in a sense, but rather coming from the place that supported that, that expressed that, that manifested that in some way. And one of the beautiful qualities is love, or loving kindness, or goodwill. To come from a place where we have, you know, as much goodwill for others as we can, and meet with that, come forward with that. The other is a sense of generosity, that it's so much nicer to be generous than it is to be miserly. So much nicer to kind of give things away, than it is to acquire. And it isn't like a moralistic thing in the sense of, you know, there's a set of external principles that I have to live by, but rather there's this guide, a feeling guide inside. And so, for me, that inner feeling guide for when I'm going to feel impulse or to say something which is unskillful, unhealthy, unethical or something, if I stay connected to that, then I won't do it. I'll feel how that feels disharmonious to do. And that's where mindfulness comes in, because I have to be mindful to be in touch with that place. I have to not be preoccupied in thoughts. I can't be caught up in all the agitation of the mind that's maybe, kind of creates cloudiness, lack of vision to what's going on. And so mindfulness, the settling of mindfulness, settling of meditation, settling of concentration, is a way to kind of touch into this ethical sensibility. And so that's what I associate with this word hiri, H-I-R-I. And here what it means, how it's usually kind of defined, it's a certain kind of feeling of wrongness or feeling of offness. Like, this doesn't feel good. Or if we respect ourselves, we kind of like are kind of shattering that self-respect. So I don't know what the best word is in English to translate this. And since they have moral shame, some people just do shame. I've seen, I think one place I saw shame and blame. Great. Let's do more of that. Lots of it, and feel good about it. But so I think of the word for my choice right now for translating the word hiri is conscience. I like the word conscience. To me, feels like a beautiful word to me personally. We all have different association with these words, but that's nice for me. And then there's the other one, otapa. And otapa comes from the root tapa, which is sometimes translated as asceticism. It means to burn, So that gives you some sense of what it can feel like, some burning inside that can exist. And this is said to be concern for the consequences of one's action. So the first is a subjective experience of concern, caring for the quality of our inner life for ourselves. The otapa is concern for the consequences our behavior can have on the world around us, and maybe even on ourselves as well. So one is the source of where we come from, the motivation, and the other is the consequences of acting on those. And so rather than calling it moral dread, a certain kind of fear of causing harm, which maybe is okay, fear of causing harm, fear of wrongdoing, I don't have too much trouble with that. But maybe to kind of soften it for myself or a little bit more inspire me or kind of for myself, I like to translate it as moral caution. Moral caution. So a sense of caution, sense of care, of attention, of paying, you know, being cautious. And it's also said to be that it's kind of the concern for what people you respect, what they would think of you. And that's an interesting reference point, to take someone who you most respect in the world, who you most value, someone who's been a big benefactor, and what would you do in their presence that would make you feel really good about yourself? And what would you do in their presence that you'd feel, well, you know, I wish they didn't see that. You know, that was unfortunate, you know. And so if we have people we respect, their example, their value, their virtues, how they evaluate what's important, how does that guide us as well? How does that protect us? Because sometimes I think it's really helpful to not only rely on our own moral compass, but sometimes, you know, personal moral compasses are not enough. Some things are pretty challenging. So to have some other reference point, friends, teachers, respected ones, can be very helpful. So these are called guardians of the world. I call them guardians of the world, guardians of the heart. For the heart, because they protect the heart from these unhealthy tendencies. And they support, the Buddha was quite explicit, that they support the growth of skillful and healthy qualities of mind. And we find in this ancient tradition a big emphasis on cultivating and growing what is healthy inside of us. Growing in faith, growing in integrity, growing in honesty, growing in mindfulness and compassion, and, you know, all these kinds of things that we can develop and grow. And so one of the leading sources of food or benefit for this are these two things, hiri and otapa. When they're present, it tends to make it hard to do things which are unskillful, and they tend to support cultivating, acting on, manifesting that which is beautiful within us. And it's also guardians of the world, because if we really stay close to these hiri and otapa, then there's so many things that we wouldn't do that would cause harm, represented by the five precepts, right? We wouldn't, or the opposite, we wouldn't kill, we wouldn't steal, engage in sexual misconduct, we wouldn't lie, and we wouldn't be involved in intoxication. And that, you know, the world has so much suffering because of people who engage in those one way or the other. So it protects others, this as well. So this ancient, or not so ancient, idea in Europe that consciousness has in it, within it, conscience. That maybe being really conscious is not separated from having a conscience. That they come together, they're one and the same perhaps. Perhaps being mindful, the awareness of mindfulness, also comes with an ethical sensibility that guides us in what we pick up and what we put down, what we live and what we don't do. And certainly it becomes a fantastic guide to begin having an inner place, an inner reference point of goodness, of wholeness, of purity, of cleanliness, of freedom, of openness, of unhinderedness, of unobstruction, of freedom, of, I don't know, there's all these wonderful words that could describe it. We don't want to be stuck just on purity. And so, hiri and otapa, conscience and moral caution. So what do you think about that? And what do you think about that I would, you know, ruffle the feathers of Western mindfulness by bringing in a little bit of ethics into it? Ethical evaluation. So yes, author, please. Is there a mic over there?
As you're speaking, three thoughts or concepts come to mind. Views, cognitive dissonance, and rationalization.
Rationalization.
Okay.
And views. And it seems like rationalization, cognitive dissonance, kind of are reinforced by views, and they seem the opposite of what you're describing. And I guess my question is about how views and hiri and otapa interact, or what the effect of overcoming views through mindfulness, I guess, related to hiri and otapa.
Well, I think the way that I was presenting it today, the way that I discovered it, was the conceptual views, ideas about what is and isn't, for example, can be sometimes such a shell or a cover over our eyes. So we see through the opinions, the stories, the beliefs that we have. And if we're caught up in that world of belief-making and opinion-making, we don't have access to the heart. And the stronger this world of beliefs, the less access we have to the heart. It's possible to get settled and quiet the mind and be settled inside and connect to the heart. It's still then possible to have some views, some opinions about things, but they don't interfere anymore. And it's possible that those views are accurate enough to be supportive for this path to freedom. So is that to relate? And I think that the more that we get settled in here, then we have an inner reference point for hiri and otapa, in our own, you know, that we really feel connected to from the inside in the heart.
Thank you for clarifying hiri. Here in the West, in Western psychology, there's often a distinction made between guilt, which is I've done something wrong, and shame, which is I am wrong. And toxic shame is often a childhood, from childhood, a place where I or somebody who has toxic shame that's unresolved because of bad messages in family and other situations. And so shame has a lot of connotations in the West that it may not have in Southeast Asia. And I find your clarification quite helpful.
So the English word shame for many people has a very negative connotation. So using it in any kind of way just triggers that for people. And now we have more reason to be ashamed. Thank you, Buddhism. occasionally I've seen the word guilt also associated with this. I think sometimes if it's Asian translators who don't know English so well, they're just kind of going through the dictionary and they find shame. So it's often been said that, especially in terms of guilt, that there's no guilt in Buddhism. I think Buddhists have guilt, but especially here in the West. but the idea being that in Buddhism, there's no healthy place for guilt, because guilt in Buddhism is considered to be a form of aversion, hostility to oneself. And, it maybe doesn't feel that way in the midst of a strong bout of guilt and what have I done and all that. There is a sense, there can be regret and remorse, and which is different than guilt. And that is, something like that is considered healthy in Buddhist psychology. So the absence of a self-hostility, but the presence of kind of feeling like, that doesn't feel good. It's like that place that Hiri and Otapa comes from. That feels really heavy now. That feels, like agitated, or feels, aching. And that's appropriate if we've done something that was harmful.
Hi. I keep thinking of the metaphor of the finger pointing at the moon. The metaphor of the finger pointing at the moon. So where do Hiri and Otapa fit with? Could you remind us what the moon represents?
The full moon?
The full moon, yes.
Sometimes in Buddhism, the full moon represents an enlightened mind, the mind that's liberated.
Right. So where do Hiri and Otapa fit in relation to enlightenment?
Where is Hiri and Otapa fit with the liberated mind? If we use the moon as the analogy for a liberated mind, maybe it's the light that shines on Hiri and Otapa.
And Hiri and Otapa are described as the guardians
of the world, yes.
Guardians of the world and of the heart.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're guarding. They are guarding enlightenment, our potential for enlightenment.
Absolutely.
Maybe you can just comment briefly. I think it was to some extent related to the first question, but one of the things that I think a lot about is the kind of moral conditioning of my childhood, and how sometimes that inner voice that I listen to isn't necessarily the inner voice of, say, a kind of a Buddhist practitioner, but it's the inner voice of the moral conditioning of my childhood. Uh-huh. And it seems genuine and authentic. And when I quiet my mind, it's still there. That's how kind of deeply entrenched.
What does genuine and authentic mean?
It's of serious concern to me. Some of these kind of moral principles that when you view it from perhaps an intellectual angle, you see maybe the bankruptcy of the concept itself. But it's still a feeling.
That feels
true and as part of who I am.
Great.
I think that that's probably something a lot of people feel. And so I just want to maybe get your comments on how do you negotiate between that voice that you're talking about, which is this ethical guide that you listen to when you quiet yourself down, and then the voice that seems to be there just as I guess it's there as well.
Great. Well, I appreciate how cognizant you are of this. I think that's a really important step in what you're asking to do. I think becoming more aware, if it's a really big enough issue for you, to do a little bit, just enough studies about ethical theory, different forms of moral principles, morality is understood in an academic way, just kind of the very simple kinds, but principle-based ethics, virtue-based ethics, consequentialist ethics, and then something called moral sentiment, those four. And then to use that to really understand where these voices are, what they are, what do you believe, where do they fit into the moral universe for yourself. Once you have some better understanding of what they are, then if you want to meditate, then you may be able to meditate through them. Because these have to do, to the degree which they're conditioned and learned, they can be unconditioned. They can be deconstructed. And this is one of the functions of strong concentration, is to really soften and settle the mind so the conditioning is not there. And because you're so familiar with it, I think you can do a more realistic job of dissolving it or settling and going below it. And then from that perspective, looking at it in a new way. And one of the new ways to look at it is to no longer identify with it. And chances are that right now, because of such a deep childhood conditioning, somehow you identify strongly with it. You really feel like it's you or it's the truth or something. So that's, I don't know if that's a satisfying answer, but that's an answer. You want to say more?
No, that's it.
So is Mike, can we pass the mic to the outer hall?
Thanks. I'm hearing a lot of what you're saying kind of in terms of a compass, a very intimate compass. Like I grew up in the 60s too, and you know, we had a psychology of you were supposed to give voice to every feeling you had, every thought you had. You weren't supposed to judge it. So there was a lot of rules, kind of moral rules built underneath that, you know, were they true or weren't they true, and what is really true. But what I'm hearing you say about these two guardians is that you can also listen to what feels good, what feels as if you are loving. You can listen to the love that you have and let that replace the conditioning you have to judge yourself. Instead of judging yourself, you're listening mindfully to what is happening inside yourself and listening to that. Heartfelt is what I'm trying to get at.
It's just, to some degree, I'm not, you know, I don't feel so comfortable saying it the way you said it. The way you said it makes sense based on what I said. So I appreciate what you said. But to only make reference to feelings as a justification for what we do is a bit dangerous. And so there's a different reference point than just what I'm feeling in this. This hearing otapa as an inner compass or in a kind of a feeling, as a subcategory of feelings, has to do with a particular way of feeling free of afflictive emotions, free of afflictive motivations. So free of things like greed and hatred and delusion, and free of clinging. And that has this feeling of wholeness or purity. Mm-hmm. So it's a very particular kind of feeling of not wanting to violate or do violence against this feeling of tenderness or this place of hearing otapa. So it's a particular kind of feeling in a sense. Now, is it just a feeling? It's a little bit hard to understand, you know, really what this is, because it's a moral sentiment kind of thing. Is it? It might be. Where does that come from within us? What arouses our hearing otapa? What it picks up? Is that only innate within us? Is it partly learned and conditioned from the world around us? There's so many different ways in which we learn our ethics and we hold our ethics. And different minds, different human beings have different kind of ways of figuring out their ethical life, choosing what to do or not to do. That this hearing otapa might be kind of, for every person, consolidation of their particular approach to ethical evaluation, but with a reference point of this feeling of purity or feeling of freedom, feeling of non-clinging. Does that make any sense?
I think you're correct in... yes. I think what I'm trying to get at is that you can mindfully evaluate what your inner reaction is to how you act in the world. And to just go by guilt and blame is very unsatisfactory. But if you go by these pillars of what you're really saying is goodness, like what is the effect of me having love for this being that I could have reacted to in a different way?
Yeah.
And to evaluate on that and build on that, that's what's liberating, and that's what helps you with the blame and guilt, because that's what we suffer from a lot.
Right. So I think that if you want to make it really simple, and this is a, if we only said the simple things, we would just repeat ourselves. So we try to make it a little more complicated to look at the different circumstances of life and make it richer for us. But I think it comes down to, in the essence of it, not causing harm to oneself or to others. And so the motivation, the to not cause harm, can come from some deep place inside. And so we have to have a feeling or a sense or understanding of what is harm and what causes it, and then feel that that's off. And that's the fundamental ethical impulse in Buddhism, is not causing harm. Yes, can we have the mic up front?
Sometimes it can be really difficult to differentiate what is not causing harm, what is the greater not harm. For example, and when is one causing harm to self or others, or when is it really important to have courage and speak out about one's truth, which may cause harm? And I think, for example, recently on the national stage, we saw that, you know, when somebody spoke her truth, and there was enormous backlash, but that no one could have anticipated what the result of, you know, of her speaking her truth was in advance. So how can we discriminate? And some people would say, well, maybe it was better she didn't do that, you know, for her sake, you know. So how does one go about making decisions when speaking one's truth can create dissension and can create harm potentially to oneself or to others?
So there's many criteria for answering that question. One of them is to use our best capacity we have to anticipate the consequences. And so, generally if you kill someone, you can anticipate that's going to cause harm. But some things are not so clear. And so we do our best from what we've learned over our life, what other people say, we try to figure out the best. And so that's one criteria, is really getting a sense of the consequences. And that sometimes takes evaluation, and sometimes, as you said, it's weighing the pluses and minuses, and what are the consequences? There might be some negative consequences, but positive consequences, and the bigger picture, what's the best for everyone involved? And so there's all kinds of things there. So consequences is one. The other is to look at our intention, to look at what's motivating us to act this way. And that's where you can feel if the motivation is to a hostile one, is I want to really stab it to that person, I really want to get back and not cause harm, then we know that the motivation is behind the motivation. Some things like greed generally is harmful, at least for ourselves. And you can, this is one of the advantages of strong meditative practice, is you can feel how greed causes harm to oneself. So that's another way of evaluating, is based on the intentions. Another way has to do with, not so much the intention, but the inner dispositions or qualities that are present. Do they feel wholesome? Do they feel unwholesome? This inner purity that's there, is that being covered over or contracted, or is it, being supported to grow more? And I think more sensitive we are on the inside, we can feel this more and more. And the fourth way is, if it involves other people, is to make sure that you feel a human connection to them. So ideally you would talk to them personally, get to know them. You wouldn't just be an abstract caricature of a person where they just represent some particular idea. This is a real human being that we're talking to or involved with, and to have some and to feel the emotional connection that comes from being close or in proximity and getting to know someone and not leave them out there as the bad other or something, you know, or the abstraction of something, and so find a way to feel that human connection, and then when that connection is felt, how would you behave? What would you do? So these are all kinds of different ways of kind of finding our way to a decision. And at different times, different ones of those are going to predominate, seem relevant and seem important, you know, or what's going to carry the day. But it does take reflection at times. The idea that we're supposed to just be able to sit and meditate, get enlightened, and we'll just naturally just kind of know what to do and just all just flows freely and I think it's a little bit of a myth. I think there are times where ethical reflection, or, you know, some people don't like the word use ethics, so reflection, careful reflection about what causes harm, what doesn't cause harm, requires some real thought and consideration and exploration. It's not a straightforward thing. So, thank you. And I think that I've given now a few different talks that are related to Buddhist ethics, and I think that's, I'm teaching this course on ethics here at IMC for a year, so I think that I have this little bit of idea that from time to time I'm going to bring in more ethical teaching this year. This is like the year of ethics at IMC. And hopefully that works okay. And I'm certainly hoping to do it in an ethical way. So one of the surprises I had when I first started practicing in Thailand was kind of flabbergasted me. And I was kind of perplexed. Why would anybody be this way? How could this be? And this is more to do about me than people in Thailand, maybe. But people there felt joy in their good ethics. And I was like, what? You'd feel joy for that? I mean, I thought that was the strangest thing when I got there. But now I feel it's a joyful thing. It took me a while. And so now I'm on board for it. So I hope that this is a happy topic, or it's going to be a happy one as we go along, because it's a wonderful thing. It's beautiful to have this beauty and have this freedom and have this purity and to be able to share it with people is a fantastic thing. And it's here for the betterment of us all. So thank you.